Bryan. It's That's Life with Mark Snyder. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Mark.
On the show before, he's with Goldmine Magazine and has written a great book. It's the ultimate guide to valuing your vinyl. It's called Goldmine's Record Album Price Guide, 50 years of collectible LPs from the 40s all the way through the 90s, and it's published by Krauss Publications. And there's some surprises in here when I was going through this, Tim. One of the ones I noticed was that Tina Louise is in here with albums that are worth up to $300. I didn't even know that Tina, I assume it's the one from Gilligan's Island.
It is the one.
Wow. Now, have you heard these at all?
I must say I've not heard her albums. I don't know whether she can really sing or not. I mean, certainly people who are Gilligan's Island's devotees remember the episode where she pretended to be Marilyn Monroe and was singing I Want to Be Loved by You.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, she at least has that sort of Connie Stevens, you know, kooky, kooky, lend me your comb kind of voice. But, and I think much of the value is for that not only is, because of the Gilligan's Island connection, but because she also poses on the cover, and there's a whole subgenre of collectors who collect cheesecake album covers.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. What are some of the more popular cheesecake album covers out there?
Well, you know, it's not an area I know a lot about, so off the top of my head, I can't really think. I mean, it's not real valuable, but probably one of the most famous would be the Herb Alpert Whipped Cream and Other Delights album cover, which, again, is a common album, so even though it's, you know, the cheesecake people are into that, there's plenty of them to go around, so just about anyone who collects it has it.
For people like myself in radio, and for people who are out there that collect albums, and now I'm collecting CDs, I didn't give in till very, very late, but I had to now. But what about the value of, like, special, what they call promo CDs, and sort of promo records, DJ copies? Are those worth more or worth less?
It depends. You know, most of them are worth, you know, fractionally more than the stock regular copies. Some of them are worth considerably more than the stock copies, and others are actually worth less than the stock copies.
Mm.
Cases like that usually is an album that's very hard to find in a stock copy. A fairly recent example, like, you know, from the late 1980s, is, you know, there's Tori Amos. Her debut album was called Why Can't Tori Read? She's sort of hard to describe it. She's sort of doing hair metal, it's a collector's item, but it's, you know, as an album, or as a CD, it's a lot harder to find one that's a stock copy than a promo copy, because no one bought it at the time.
Now, I'm just looking at a guest I had on last week, Barry Mann, who's in your book, and one of his albums is worth $300.
Yeah.
Wow.
One with. Probably the one with Who Put the Bomp in the Bomp a Bomp a Bomp.
Yeah, the stereo version.
Yes.
Yeah. Now,
well, early rock and roll stereo is usually pretty hard to find. So that's a, you know, if you look up early Roy Orbison albums, some of the early Elvis stereo albums, Del Shannon's Runaway in stereo, they're all really hard to find.
Hmm. Here's another one of those things we're talking about, the promos, Manfred Mann. Mm-hmm. Most of this stuff is, you know, in the $40, $50 range new. But they have an interview album that is worth up to $200.
Yeah, those are the promos that tend to be worth the most, is ones that don't exist in a form that was released to the general public. You'll see that throughout the book. You know, in the 1970s, there was a series of albums that was put out by Columbia. It was called Everything You Always Wanted to Hear by, you know, Fill in the Blank and Were Afraid to Ask For. And they were basically promotional greatest hits type albums, and in many cases those are the most, in some cases are the most sought after albums in the entire discography for some of the artists.
Here's somebody I never even heard of before. This is interesting when you see something that you never even heard of and it's worth a fortune. Reverend Columbus Mann.
Yes.
Is that a gospel singer?
Yes. He was from Detroit, which they Shall Be Mine, the album you're talking about, was generally believed only to have been released in the Detroit area. And this is before Tamla Motown. It was on the Tamla label. Before they'd had, they'd had a couple national hits. Shop Around had been big, and Please Mr. Postman. But they still were, they still were a label in Detroit. So they did stuff for the local market, and that's what that record is.
And the other one on a different label on Wingate is worth $900.
Yeah.
He satisfies me. I never heard of either one of those.
Yeah, and Wingate was another Detroit label. So the guy was a preacher in Detroit, and that's who they geared the records toward, and they're sought after by collectors of gospel music.
And you look at people like Bob Marley, who's dead,
Yes. And
there's really not much collectible with him. There's one album here worth $100, a promotional package.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's really not much there.
And that's because most of his albums sold very well. Dead or Alive, if their albums are easy to find, they're not going to go up in value. You look at, using a very broad example, Frank Sinatra. There are some of his albums that will never be worth a whole lot of money because they're so easy to find. Whereas living artists, some of them can have some extremely valuable albums.
There's a good one, Jay Mansfield Busts Up Las Vegas.
Yes.
$200 for that one. That must have a good picture on the cover, too.
Yes, it does. I've seen a picture of that one. Yes, it does. It's a typical 50s push-up bra kind of thing, So.
Tell you, I'm looking through this book here. This is a great book, folks, just for nostalgia's sake, even, the record album Price Guide from Goldmine and Tim Neely. But here's Charles Manson, same Charles Manson.
The very one.
And he's got an album that's worth up to $200.
Yes. Of course, most normal people won't pay that for it. In fact, most people would probably, there are probably many people who would take a copy of his album and break it over their knee, after he became infamous, he had made these tapes. He always thought he was going to be a rock and roll singer, but he was pretty bad.
Wasn't that the connection with Terry Melcher?
Yeah, and also with Dennis Wilson.
Yeah.
Dennis Wilson hung out with Charles Manson for a while. And
didn't they record one of his songs?
Yes, they did. Under a different name, they changed the name of the song, and I think Dennis Wilson is credited as the sole composer on the song. But they did. It was a song that Charles Manson wrote called "Cease to Exist," which became with the Beach Boys' "Never Learn Not to Love." And of course, also Guns N' Roses did one of the Charles Manson song on their covers album several years ago.
That's right, yeah. But I never heard the music. I don't know if you have, but
No, I haven't. And from what I've heard, it's basically what I've described. It's someone who thinks he can be a star, and songs just aren't very good.
See, the coolest thing about this book, Tim, is that you don't know who you're going to find.
Oh, yeah.
The name right underneath Jane Mansfield, Charles Manson, the next one is Mickey Mantle.
Yes.
Now, I didn't know he could sing or he had sung anywhere.
Well, he didn't. See, in fact, I even have a picture of that album in the book. If you thumb up to page 299, I have a picture of the album. And basically, he basically chose some songs that he liked that happened to be owned by RCA, and they put his name on it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did it sell?
No, it didn't.
I guess not, because it's a collector's item now.
Sure. And probably got very little distribution outside of the New York area. but nonetheless, it is a sought-after collector's item, not only by record collectors, but certainly by baseball memorabilia collectors and collectors of just the weird and strange stuff.
You know what I find is interesting? This is a really interesting thing. William Shatner, who now makes fun of his own voice on these Prairie Line commercials, he's horrid, horrid singer. But yet, his stuff is worth in the $50, $60 range. But I thought this was really interesting, because one of the albums that he released on an independent label, Lemley, was reissued by KTEL, and now is worth more when the KTEL form.
Yes.
Why would that be?
Why would that be?
Is it because the quality's better?
I am honestly not sure. I think it's probably because it's harder to find.
You would think there'd be more KTEL versions out there than the other one, though.
You would think so, but I don't know. I never saw that album when it was around. So I, the only thing I could think of is maybe the other version has crept out again since 1977 when it first came out. You know, maybe there was the famous warehouse stash of them somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the same was not true with the K-Tel record.
Now I'm looking to see if Leonard Nimoy is in here, but I do not see him.
Oh, I think he is.
Really?
Oh, let's see. Since I got the book in front of me, he's got to be in here.
See, I see N-E-L goes to N-E-O, so Nimoy would not be in here.
It's he's spelled N-I-M-O.
Oh, duh. Okay.
Page 334.
All right, so he is in here. I wanted to compare the two and see if he had something worth more.
It's a wash.
Yeah, it is. But Nimoy's got a lot more out there, though.
Yeah, and some of them are legitimately just spoken word kind of things, like the ones he did on the Cademon label.
Mm-hmm.
He basically read books and that kind of thing, spoken word kind of thing. Whereas the ones on Dot, he definitely is trying to sing, so.
Trying is the key.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's funny, one of my favorite groups of all time is a group that no one's ever heard of, but they did a song called Things I'd Like to Say, a group called New Colony 6.
Yep.
And I noticed one of their albums is worth $500.
Yes, because their first album, Breakthrough, was only released independently. It was very much of a vanity kind of thing. Whereas the second album on the same label actually came out through Cameo Parkway Records. It got national distribution, so it's not as hard to find.
Now, did Breakthrough have Things I'd Like to Say on it?
No, that actually comes later. Things I'd Like to Say, I believe, is on one of the two Mercury albums.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Mm. And I noticed you also have a lot of stuff from Mike Nesmith, aside from the Monkees.
Yes.
None of it really worth much.
Well, I mean, it's for items released in the 1970s, it's worth much, compared to, and even compared to the Monkees as a group, a lot of it has significant value. And most of the Monkees albums, except for the really late ones, are relatively common. They're not easy to find in near mint condition, but they're common in lesser condition. The Monkees and more of the Monkees, they're relatively common.
Oh, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
I see them all the time at flea markets for 50 cents.
Oh, yeah, and that's about right, but finding them in near mint condition is a dicier proposition. You just don't see them in, it's like early Beatles albums. You don't see them in near mint condition very often.
Let me ask you a question, since we're talking about that, for folks out there listening that buy this book and see very good plus in a near mint condition.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference on those?
Well, basically, near mint, I describe as, imagine that you just bought the record at a retail store and have just brought it home and are putting it on the turntable for the first time. That's what near mint looks like. It doesn't mean it's never been played, but it means, it looks like it's never been played. In other words, maybe someone played it once or twice or even a relatively few number of times. There's no obvious signs of wear to the record. The cover is 100% intact. It looks brand new. Doesn't have any cutout markings or anything like that on it.
What about writing?
No writing on it.
Mm-hmm.
Writing, diminishes the value. Writing on the record drops it from near mint right away.
I have, in my collection here, I have thousands of records because I'm really into this stuff,
mm-hmm.
as I'm sure you are. And I have some of the most collectible albums you can get, but they all have, for instance, a collectible JFK salute album that came out right after he died.
Mm-hmm.
There was only 1,000 of them made. I drew in a beard and, I ruined every album. The Monkees, I have all their mono versions, which some of them are worth $100,
yes.
gone because I put little notes on them.
Yeah, that drops the value significantly.
Yeah.
People are paying top dollar for the most perfect copies of the records, and once you get below that, they'll pay a lot less for them.
Now, my records are completely unscratched.
Yeah.
Is that part of this? I mean, if you have scratches on them, does that kind of kill the value?
Oh, it certainly can. As I mentioned in the preface to the book, most people who grade records or albums give a grade to one grade to the cover and one grade to the record.
Mm-hmm.
And the near mint in the book would be sort of a combined, if both the cover and the record are near mint. It obviously, I mean, the way you can do it is sort of split it in half and take it from there. If the cover is VG plus and the record is near mint, it would probably fall in between the VG plus and near mint value. That's kind of the way you look at these things.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I've spoken to probably 90% of the people in this book who have, put these records out, mm-hmm. and a lot of the folks don't even have copies of their own records. Did you know that?
Yeah, I've heard that. And I can believe that. They get so involved in, just recording and touring and whatever that, a record can be released and that the only way they know it's coming out is people are saying, great new record or whatever, Because a lot of times, records are often recorded, weeks to months before they actually come out. And they're already working on the next project, either getting ready to tour, getting a road band together or whatever, or maybe even in some cases getting the next album ready. Mm. I would imagine too that some people don't even have a provision in their contracts to get copies of their own records. or in some cases, it's so now. I mean, it's so temporal. It's like authors who don't have copies of their own books.
It's interesting
too.
Yeah, some of the new artists I talk to for the past few years who are dealing with CDs will actually buy the CDs at discount from their record companies and sell them at their concerts themselves.
Yeah.
So they all have copies, tons of copies, too many copies of their CDs.
Yeah.
Because they're easily packaged up and easily kept, as you know and I know. You try to keep albums, it takes a lot of space.
Sure.
I assume you must be a major record collector?
Well, I have over 10,000 45s and over 10,000 albums, so
yeah.
I guess I could make me a major collector.
Yeah. What about CDs?
I have a few hundred of them.
Yeah. So you're relatively new at that, huh?
Well, actually not. Well, I bought my first CD in 1987, so it's not, I guess I've been working on that for 13 years now.
Hmm. Goldmine, of course, the place to check and see all your values of everything you have, and if you're looking to buy any kind of record at all, you can find it in Goldmine, usually in the classifieds. This is the Goldmine record album price guide from Tim Neely. Over 40,000 records listed and priced, and it's from Krauss Publications, and a great buy at only about $25. Thanks so much for coming on, Tim.
And thanks for having me.